Hi, and welcome to Strangers on the Internet, a podcast about making online dating work for you. My name is Irina Mehta, and I'm a professor at the Maurice A. Dean School of Law at Hofstra University, also a dating coach and a consultant for the dating app industry.
And I am Michelle Lang, a senior lecturer in psychology at Christopher Newport University in Virginia, and a clinical psychologist in private practice. All views expressed on this podcast are our own and not our employers.
In the dating world, the word addiction triggers alarms. It suggests that a person is consumed by their relationship to a given vice, and with that being the primary relationship in their life, it raises the understandable question of how much they have to meaningfully and reliably contribute to being with someone else in a dating context. We've talked with prior guest Felicia Hermley about under what conditions it might make sense for someone in recovery from a substance addiction to re-enter the dating world. But what about when the addiction is not to a substance, but rather to sex or to porn? Sex is something that's a part of most romantic relationships, so does that get more complicated? Today we welcome psychotherapist DJ Burr, who will talk with us about considerations when it comes to sex addiction and dating. We are pleased to have DJ Burr joining us today. DJ is a licensed psychotherapist specializing in sexual addiction, codependency, and trauma recovery. He is a published author, speaker, and screenwriter. As a person in long-term recovery from various addictions and a survivor of a dysfunctional childhood, DJ dedicates his practice to helping those on their path to recovery and wholeness. He believes that healing those parts of our inner children who didn't get enough of what they needed to thrive is essential in breaking through pain, shame, and guilt. DJ, welcome to Strangers on the Internet. We hope that in having you here, we can look at the intersection of sex addiction and dating from two different angles. What dating is like for someone who has a sex addiction, and also what those without a sex addiction should be aware of when on the dating market, where different people are seeking different things. You speak openly about your personal history and how it informs the work that you do. What makes working with those who are struggling with sex addiction so rewarding for you?
Hi, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. What makes it rewarding for me, I get to see people like take control of their lives and engage in a more healthy, loving relationship with themselves and with other people. And, you know, I really appreciate when my clients show up with their vulnerability, with their concerns, their fears, and I help them just like, you know, explore it all. And it's a rewarding career path that I've chosen for myself.
That's really wonderful to hear. I think when we can see our clients for the whole of who they are, not just this one thing that they're dealing with, but also, you know, we can have an informed understanding of how that thing creates one lens through which they see the world. It allows us to have empathy for them and the struggles that they're dealing with. And so for you too, having had your own personal histories that are relevant to some of the issues your clients are going through, I'm sure that also helps with your empathy and with your desire to want to see them win, to want to see them come out ahead and thrive. And so it must feel very rewarding working with a population that you feel a special connection to.
Yeah, you're right. I do want to see them win. And I was on the other side of it. And a lot of times when clients come to see me, they already know some of that information about my own personal story, whether they've heard me speak, they've read an article or a book, or they've, you know, listened to my podcast, or maybe they've even seen me in a 12-step meeting. And so being transparent about my own recovery has just been really rewarding for me, but I also see like how it has benefited some of my clients. I mean, I have gotten clients directly as a result of me sharing my story.
I think that makes sense. And, you know, it's not something we typically think about. So you and I being in the therapist world, we know that a lot of the times therapists don't share a ton about themselves, like in their marketing or even in sessions. But there are circumstances under which it really makes sense to, and some populations, too, for which it would be especially helpful for a client to know and might make them feel especially safe. And so I think it's really brave that you're willing to share, you know, I'm not interested in this as purely an academic or scholarly matter. I'm interested in this because I've seen what it looks like in real life, and to put yourself out there. Of course, for anyone who's ever been a therapy client, you know that it's intimidating going into a session where you're there because you're dealing with something that you don't feel like you're dealing with great, that you don't know how to deal with, that you need help with. And to talk to somebody who we might look at as they have all the answers, or, you know, they're not the one with the problem, I am, can feel not great, can feel very hierarchical. Whereas a better relationship with a therapist is where you feel a certain level of comfort and connection. So it sounds like really off the bat, because of your style of doing things, clients are going to go in with less intimidation off the bat. So when it comes to some of the areas you specialize in, of course, honing in on sex addiction, that's one that's going to be relevant to our audience, to our show, because sex is a part of dating. And so when we think of sex, I mean, hopefully for most of us, we think of that as an enjoyable thing. But like with many fun activities, there's circumstances under which pursuing it is healthy and positive, and other circumstances under which pursuing it can actually be unhealthy. Could you offer some guidance on where that line might be drawn? Specifically, like under what conditions might a person's interest in sex start to be detrimental?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, and I think it does vary from person to person, but usually what I see is people using sex to suppress how they're feeling, right? And using sex as an escape, and also maybe even fantasy, right? Escaping into a world that they have some control over, when maybe in real life they feel powerless. And, you know, a lot of people that I work with use sex and pornography as a means to distance themselves away from that pain. And so I would think if someone is exploring relationships and they're exploring dating, if they're noticing that they're not, like, they're disconnected from the process, they're disconnected from their feelings, or disconnected from the person, and they're engaging in a pattern of behavior that is, one, probably maybe even outside of their value system, which I see often, right? That's taking a lot of their time and effort. That's distorting their perception about what's actually happening in that dating process, then is probably problematic.
What do we know about why sex addiction occurs? So like what needs are getting met? Are they mainly physical? Is it a way to connect? Is it a validation of one's attractiveness or worth as a human being? Is it different things for different people? How does one end up there?
It's different things for different people, but you know, in my experience, my own personal experience and how I show up as a provider, I most often see shame as a factor, right? People escaping that intolerable reality of feeling shame, also guilt. And in my practice, most people that I see who are dealing with sexual addiction have also experienced trauma. And so that's one of the things that we absolutely have to work on, is addressing the underlying trauma.
When you talk about the shame and guilt that people come with, it could be about anything, right? It's more like looking to sex is a means through which to respond to or escape from that shame and guilt. It's not that sex necessarily is linked to what the shame or guilt is about.
Well, I think some people feels lots of shame about the type of sex they might be interested in, the type of sex that they've experienced in their history. People are may feel shame about the fantasies that they have. You know, I think it does vary. And I think that's why it's very necessary to be in therapy and to be open and engaging in exploring the history, so we can try to identify like what is the root here and attack that head on.
I think it's so helpful. You know, there's a value to working with somebody who has experience in a particular area. And so for you as a sex addiction therapist, recognizing over the many clients you've worked with that there often is a trauma history. Of course, that doesn't mean that's true for everyone, but I think it must make you also more comfortable asking about it and explaining to clients why you would be asking about it if that's not something that they are immediately forthcoming with. Like, I'm not a sex addiction therapist, but I am thinking of one client I had worked with at one point who I was working with her on a variety of things, but one of the things was a history of sexual abuse. And that had been when she was a child, unfortunately. And then as an adult, a young adult, in the course of our work together, not even one of the earlier things she talked about, but at one point she came in to the session and did, and she looked very ashamed, and I could tell like something just felt really wrong to her. And what it was, she wanted to ask about a sexual proclivity she had found that she thought she was interested in, but she wondered, is there something wrong with me for being attracted to this kind of sex? And I appreciated that I knew her trauma history at the time to understand why she thought there might be something wrong with her, and that we could incorporate talking about both why you might think this, but why that isn't something wrong with you. And even though, you know, you have this trauma, you have the right to be attracted to whatever you are sexually. So I've had that experience, you know, in my limited work, talking to people about their sexual preferences as it might relate to past traumas. How is it for you? Do you find yourself bringing, like asking them if there was a trauma history, or do they typically disclose that without you asking?
I'd say the majority of the clients that come in to see me know that there is a trauma history, and they bring that up in the intake. But, you know, asking about trauma is something I do in the very first session. I think it's important.
That makes sense. I imagine you frame it in such a way, too, because I think that must be scary for people to hear is, oh, my gosh, I'm going to go to a therapist's office and they're going to ask about trauma in the first session. But I think you, you know, would be able to normalize it as like, here's why I'm asking about it. Here's how it might relate to other things you're dealing with. And so in your experience, clients do tend to be receptive to that.
They do tend to be receptive. One of the ways that I kind of guide this is by looking at, like, what are some core beliefs that they have about themselves, and try to identify, like, where that might come from. And usually it's, you know, from the trauma history, right? You know, I mentioned about shame earlier, and shame is one of the primary reasons people come into therapy, right? Because they're in a lot of pain, they don't understand it, and shame is different than guilt. Right? You know, shame is this core belief that there's something wrong with me. And you know, it's just my experience that that's what drives people into therapy to get help.
So when we look at people who are in recovery, they're often advised to avoid triggering events and triggering situations. With a sex addiction, does that mean refraining from dating if the person is single? Is there a point during recovery when it's like okay to date again? Is that something the person would discuss with their therapist? So I guess we talked a little bit about the entry point, and this is a bit about the exit point, right? Like, when is it kind of safe again?
Yeah. I mean, for me, as a person who's also in recovery, it was important for me to have some sobriety. You know, when I entered into the world of recovery, I was in a long-term relationship, but I ended up exiting that relationship. So I had to start fresh in recovery and then dating in recovery for the very first time as a sober person. And I had to do that with support of a therapist, support of a sponsor, and a dating plan, right? Mm-hmm. And so that plan really kind of outlined what my needs and wants were, and taking into account like what problematic behaviors in the past looked like and what I wanted to avoid moving forward. And so I think it's essential for folks to sit down with, you know, maybe it is a therapist, maybe it is a sponsor, or it could just be a peer, to help kind of identify like a roadmap of, you know, what does it look like? What are those red flags? What are the green flags? What are the yellow flags?
I think that makes a lot of sense. We know that with dating, so many people treat it as almost like a thoughtless thing. Like, sometimes you ask people, oh, you're dating now? Like, what are you looking for? They're like, I don't know. Like, you know, just kind of whatever's out there. We'll just see. I'm just exploring. Whereas, like, in this particular kind of situation, you know, if you're re-entering the dating world, newly sober, you know, it's so important to be intentional, to know what you're looking for, to know, as you said, the red flags. And so I want to call back to a couple things you had mentioned earlier when we had asked, like, what would be signs that somebody is kind of more guided by their addiction than really about connecting with people. And you had said things like, are they actually interested in the person that they're talking to, or more on like the behaviors, the activities? How much time and effort are they spending on this? Like, is it to the exclusion of other things in their life? Like, we'd be concerned with any addiction if they're just addictively on the apps or just seeking out conversation left and right rather than truly being interested in getting to know a person or whatever their goals are. But like you said, for yourself, you came up with a plan. You identified, you were clear about what I am looking for. And I wonder sometimes if it might be valuable too, maybe you did say this, like with red flags, to identify what would be behaviors of myself if I start to see them that indicate this is me going down a bad path. Or two, would it also be red flags with the people you're interacting with on the dating apps or otherwise out in the dating world, things to spot and be like, this may not be a good match for me? Could you talk more about like what those plans might include?
Yeah, so, you know, specifically, if we're going to start with like the red flags, I call them deal breakers, right? So you don't have to have four red flags to make a decision. Where I'm from, you know, you see one and you're done. Right. For me, it was very problematic to be on particular apps. So it's like, okay, so I'm not going to go on this particular app that doesn't align with my values, that doesn't align with my goals. And so I'm off of that. Right. But if I was to go on some, you know, other app, I'm not going to name the names, but it might be, you know, age might play a factor into it. Location might play a factor into it. You know, I know people who say, I don't want to date someone who lives an hour away. That doesn't make sense for me, right? So maybe that's a red flag for you. Red flags could be, does this person, especially if I'm a person in recovery, is this person, do they drink? Do they participate in drug use? What are their social habits, right? So those are things that you got to pay attention to. And so for each person, it is going to be different. But I think it's important to kind of outline that for yourself. And that's something that a lot of people don't even think about until it's too late.
I could easily see that being the case where, like, again, like people are just not being intentional. They're just going into it, just thinking about it as something fun or like extracurricular rather than like, no, like you're actually interacting with other people and something could come from this, something that's good for you and the other person or something that's not good for you or the other person. And so I think being intentional is super important. I love what you said about not only the importance of like, yeah, actually come up with a plan, like really think through what it is that you're looking for here and what would be those deal breakers. And we agree with you, by the way, we've talked about it on this show several times. The deal breaker means that's it. No matter what else is good about this person or this situation, if the deal breaker is true, that's it. But I also like what you said about, okay, you can come up with the plan on your own if you're clear on what it is that you want, if you'll be honest with yourself, but it's also fine to call in support. And that support can be a professional. It doesn't have to be. It could be a sponsor. It could be a friend. And so I think that's also really helpful advice to our listeners is you don't have to do it all on your own. You can if that's what you feel so inclined towards, but if in your heart of hearts, you feel like you don't have enough insight to really help yourself work through your plan, or you'd like a second set of eyes on it or a second set of brains to give you ideas, that it's fine to pull in somebody else too, fine and encouraged.
I had a dating group when I started the process. I had a plan and I had a group. We met regularly where we would share kind of dating updates and get real time like feedback via text when we were out and about, maybe even before the date or right after the date, like a bookend. We call that in recovery. It's like you're checking in and you're checking out, right? I actually needed that. I needed some handholding after, you know, very chaotic experiences pre-recovery in relationships. And so, you know, it can be structured however they need it to be.
Do you think the online environment generally, where people, I mean, this has been talked about somewhat, where people can literally toggle back and forth between the dating apps that have real people on them and porn sites that, well, they also often have real people, but they're not people that you're likely to meet. Then they just sort of go back and forth between these porn sites. They watch some movie video there, and then they come back to the dating app environment, sometimes kind of automatically get into that lingo with people that might have been used in the porn movie, right? Where they're immediately telling the other person, oh, I want to do this and this and this to you. Do you think that the reality gets kind of blurred in some people's minds, and that just this general environment breeds sex addiction and or makes it harder to escape from?
You know, it's just my personal opinion that pornography in and of itself is going to breed dysfunction. And that's what I've seen and that's what I know from my own personal experience. And there was no way that I could, like, really show up in a dating environment by also being attached to pornography. It just didn't make sense, right? And it was very distorted. I think it's beyond blurred. It's, like, distorted. And so it wasn't until I was able to break free from all of that before I could even pursue dating in a healthy way.
So you would say, like, there is sort of, for a lot of people or for everyone, no healthy way to consume pornography.
My personal opinion, there's no way to consume pornography in a healthy way. As I haven't seen it.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Can you just talk more about, like, and I think some of these things have been talking points, but I think other things people don't necessarily know, and maybe especially young people haven't heard it or haven't heard it from somebody like you who's a professional. Like, what is the problem with pornography, even if it's, let's say, not the most violent kind, even if it's not, you know, we're taking out a lot of the worst stuff, right? Like, what is it about it that is going to create psychological and, well, sometimes even physical problems?
Well, the thing is like, a lot of people are exposed to pornography early on. At least, you know, when I'm working with someone who's maybe 30 or 40, they maybe were exposed very young. Nowadays, you know, we're finding that kids, like, you know, 8 and 9 are accessing iPhones, right? And there's no filters that are protecting them, right? And so maybe they don't stumble into hardcore porn the first click, but I always see escalation. Right. There's not. And I know that, you know, in society now, there are hopes of having more guardrails and boundaries and protections for youth. And I absolutely stand for that. But sometimes even that's not enough. And so it's novel. Right. And we chase things that are novel. And so it can increasingly get out of control, especially if there's no intervention early on.
You know, if I think about pornography, I can share some things from my own experiences. One is the first time I ever saw pornography was in college with a group of friends that were doing it as kind of a funny thing. Like, they were like, let's look at, it was like one of the ones with like a loose plot or something like that. And I remember at that time, I was just so disgusted by the idea of it. Like, it just, if anything, it was a sign that I was probably not at the level of maturity where I really, it made sense for me to think about sex in that kind of way as like entertainment or something like that, which I guess pornography is supposed to be. But then later on, like when I was a more established adult, you know, and I've seen some like pornography videos, you know, some of my first thoughts is, oh my gosh, this is not how people really talk to each other. I hope that, you know, and I don't know that I would have known that as a younger person. If I were watching it, I might have thought, oh, I guess this is just the way it is, you know? And so that's really concerning in some ways. I mean, some of it is almost laughable when I'm like, she is not having an orgasm right now, despite the fact that she's saying she is, you know? Sometimes it's that, but other times it is, I would not like somebody to talk to me that way. And I can't believe they're normalizing that. And so I can certainly appreciate when somebody doesn't have an existing basis for what a healthy sexual relationship could look like, if they're getting that sense of things from pornography. I mean, pornography is, I think, like most of the time, a warped view of things. I can't say that I'm an expert in it enough to really to speak broadly to it, but from my experience, I would say what I've seen does not feel particularly realistic. And it does make you wonder if people are taking that in and taking that as normal or the way things should be, or thinking from that, oh, I guess that must be what people want to feel or want to hear. I could see how that could cause problems in their actual dating life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was exposed in elementary school. And it continued to get worse as I got older, as, you know, exposure to like the internet and things like that. I mean, for me personally, I really went off the deep end. I was a sophomore in high school doing a research paper, and just with a couple clicks on the Google search, or maybe not even Google at the time, I think it was Yahoo, my whole life like went into a tailspin, chaos, right? And what I saw, I thought was normal, and I knew I wanted more of it, and I took every opportunity that I had to pursue it, right, to the detriment of sleep, my own health, my relationships with family. I mean, I didn't know anything about filters and deleting cookies and all those things, and so everyone found out about it. You know, and the problem that, in my opinion, that happened was that no one did anything about it. And so I think it's important that even if children have early exposure to pornography, even if it's outside of like the parents' controls and things, there has to be some kind of conversation and intervention. And so when I see clients come in to see me, most of them were exposed very early. Their parents found out about it, and there was no conversations about it. So there was no information about whether or not this was appropriate. There was no conversation about what to actually expect. And so pornography was left as the sexual educator. And that's unfortunate.
You spoke, or I guess we did, in our giving an intro about you, of the inner child kind of work that you do with your clients. And the idea behind that for our listeners is that all of us have a part of us that is our inner child, part of us that still has those childish wants, that just want things to be the way we want them to be, the parts of us that are vulnerable and needed protection. And now we're these adults, but we still have that inner part within us. And so when you work with people who talk to you about having been exposed to pornography from an early age, but then no one in their life did anything about it, do you say to them things like now, like in their 30s or 40s, like, I'm sorry you were exposed to that. I'm sorry no one acted like that was a concern, that no one helped you to process that? And how is it for your clients to hear that even at like 30 or 40 years old?
Most often they cry because there's some emotions attached to that, right? Because that early exposure was probably very chaotic and confusing for them, and maybe even frightening depending on what they saw. Right. And so when they are sitting in front of me and I'm able to kind of validate that, wow, that must have been really scary for you and maybe also exciting. Right. And I think a lot of them feel that validation, and I encourage them to get accurate information. Right. And so part of that is something that I might offer a resource, or, you know, I'm not a sex therapist. And so if appropriate, I might offer another referral, or at least an adjunct, someone that I might know that can help support them in, you know, further, you know, informing themselves about sex in general, right? Maybe even information about their own bodies, because that probably was lacking too. And so I think my clients really feel that that empathy and compassion, because I do have that experience of being that vulnerable kid who was exposed earlier to some really awful things that no one corrected.
Yeah, it's, you know, as you two were talking, I started thinking about like the first time that I ran into pornography, and it wasn't the internet, because I grew up in Europe, and after a certain time of the evening, they would start showing like what were essentially pornographic movies, and there were also commercials that were like, you know, like call this phone number to have like whatever, someone talk dirty to you for whatever amount of money. And I think I had like recorded the Romeo and Juliet movie, you know, the one with like DiCaprio and Claire Danes, etc. And I think they actually showed a porn version of Romeo and Juliet before. So I think the very beginning of what I had recorded was that. And it was all I think I saw was like two people having basically sex in a grave, like while everybody else was like at their funeral. And it was like, okay, well, that's kind of weird. Like it wasn't, you know, it wasn't frightening. It was just like, I think because it was so common, because this stuff was on late night TV all the time, like people were more like making fun of it. Maybe like what you were describing, Michelle, with the college kids that were like, oh, well, whatever. But it is true that it seems for most of, I don't know, history, for most of modern history, sex education has been kind of chaotic and disorganized and not thought out. Right. And like where people, like what DJ is describing, like where people are going to get their information from, like the first source is usually not going to be their parents or schools. It's going to be some random like other kid. There are stories of like kids like running around their school showing pornography on their phones these days, right? Like as a joke or as like to like annoy somebody or whatever. And it's pretty disconcerting. When we go back to the apps, one thing that Michelle and I have talked a lot about is people not being honest about their intentions. So there are some examples of like financial fraud taking place on the apps. What about how much of a problem is it in terms of like people you've worked with and what they've experienced on dating apps, that people pretend that what they want is a relationship, but they're really looking for sex? And I'm thinking maybe especially for somebody who's in recovery from sex addiction, and now they're trying to get like an emotional connection with someone, and boom, before you know it, you kind of fell into someone's trap almost, like, or the person, like, it suddenly turns out, oh no, that's not what this person wanted, even though maybe that's what they promised they were after. That must be very painful.
You know, I think it is painful, and there are a lot of people out there, I guess the term is catfishing, and, you know, essentially lying to get their needs met, right? And so, you know, it's important to also think about, like, you know, what are those, you know, boundaries that you have in place, and what are the questions that you might ask to get information about what the person might be actually available for. But I think a lot of times it's more about like protecting yourself by not, let's say, going to someone's house on a first date, right? Or even a second or a third date, you know, being out in public, not interacting with them all times of day and night. So it's really about having some intentional, having boundaries and communicating effectively. And not being, I think there's this really popular term out there now, it's like love bombing, right? Being told all the wonderful things about who you are and being given flowers and gifts and all the things, right? And for someone who's really vulnerable, that can feel like a breath of fresh air. It's like, oh my goodness, you know, I finally have that person. Yeah, that's a red flag. You know, and so it's an interesting, I'm glad that I'm not on the dating apps. I'm glad that I've, you know, found recovery and that I had a plan and I'm happily married now using that plan that I developed in my recovery, because what's happening now in the dating sphere, like it's like the Wild Wild West.
Yeah. Like, do you have a sense from working with clients who are still single, how much of a challenge it is to them, the app specifically, because they are wild and they are rife with people who aren't looking for what they say they are looking for. They are rife with people who are flaky. And so amongst your single clients who are recovering, and specifically for those who are recovering from sex addiction, are the apps a dangerous place for them? Do they find it challenging to be on the apps?
They do find it challenging to be on the apps, and they have to be selective in terms of which apps. I think there may be problems on all the apps, right? Because people bring their stuff wherever they go, right? Yeah. And so one of the things that, you know, my clients, I try to support them in like having, you know, interactions in real time with people, like going to events and stuff. So not spending a whole lot of time on apps, but bringing it into the real life, bringing it into like an event space, right, where they can get some one-on-one time with someone and really see if this is a person that they're going to mesh well with. Because if you're sitting on the phone for 2 weeks, you know, chatting with someone 6 hours a day, right, they can tell you anything. But if someone's sitting right in front of you, you can pick up on those nonverbals, everything. Right. You can get more accurate information, I think. And so I typically encourage people to don't spend a lot of time on the apps with one or two people. Bring that in real life.
You know, that tends to be the sort of advice I think Irina and I have generally given, or at least that we've done in our own dating lives, is we're quicker to meet people on the front end. And that's just as you said, so that you can get a feel for what the chemistry is like in person, but also, like, especially if you're worried about, is somebody who they say they are, like, not just in terms of Do they look like that? But do they want what they say they want? I think asking them to put a little effort in, you know, to show up in person, if they really aren't that interested in you as a person, you know, they're less likely to actually put that effort in. Or if all they really want is sex and you're suggesting, let's go out for coffee or something like that, where there's no chance of sex being involved, you know, will they show up for something like that? And so I think like your thoughts there are really good and helpful for our listeners. You know, we hear a lot from people that they don't like the idea of a coffee date or something like that. It just feels not committed enough. But I think there's multiple real values to it. One of which is just being, will people show up who actually just want to have a conversation, like just want to get to know you, and with nothing else that there's a question, could that be a part of it? Plus just the effort to show up. So I think that's some really solid advice. I hope our listeners will take heed.
I was also wondering, as part of this, just because this relates to a number of conversations I've been having, and there was also just an article a couple of days ago about, it was about speed dating in New York City, and how a lot of those events that are trying to, you know, have not everything happen online, right, that basically it's mostly women signing up for heterosexual interactions. Do you have any advice? And that tends to be the story a lot. Like, you join a reading group as a heterosexual woman, guess what? It's going to be like mostly other heterosexual women there. And so do you have any advice for heterosexual women specifically who tend to, many of them tend to feel like, well, I'm trying to have these in-person interactions, I'm trying to do other things, but it's like, where are all the straight men? Like, where, you know, where should they go? Or what kinds of, also, if to the extent they do use the apps, like, are there sort of particular things that they should look out for when it comes to, you know, kind of like danger signs or things? I mean, the love bombing you brought up, it's certainly one of them. And Michelle and I have talked about that, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts are for that population.
You know, that's a good question. It really is. I'm not sure I have, anything different to share, except for maybe not necessarily doing like a speed dating activity, but maybe some other activity, like whether that's a sporting activity or an art activity, you know, doing a meetup or something, some kind of outdoor exercise related thing, or nature, something, right? Because I think you're right. I think a lot of heterosexual women are showing up to these events, and then not so many men are showing up. And that's unfortunate. I don't know how we address that, how we change that, other than making sure that the people who are putting on these events actually know how to market.
No, I think that's true. And I think there's often this question of like, well, where are the straight guys, right? And sometimes the answer tends to be, well, they didn't want to put in the effort, right? And then the next question is, well, if it's someone who doesn't even want to put in the effort to show up to this one thing, is it really somebody that's going to put in the effort for a whole bunch of other things having to do with relationships? So, of course, we have much deeper kind of cultural problems there. So, Michelle, I think you want to ask a question. Am I seeing that right?
Yeah, yes. You're right. Sorry, please. I forgot. I'm giving tells. But so,
that's all right. Go ahead.
No, I was actually thinking, so we're talking about, you know, dating's tough enough as is, just finding somebody who you're interested in, who seems to be interested in the same things as you. Say you're on the apps or anywhere, you meet somebody, you hit it off, and you do feel like there's something there. And now you find out that the person who you're interested in, they disclose to you that they are in recovery from a sex addiction. So if that's me, if I'm dating somebody, newly dating them, interested in them, and they disclose, you know, I'm in recovery from sex addiction, what are things that I would need to know? So, like, what advice would you give to daters who are considering dating somebody who describe themselves as in recovery from sex addiction? What would be helpful for them to know about? How can I, you know, be safe and careful myself, and also, you know, not cause a trigger for the person who's in recovery, or be a support for them?
So I would say to, one, not make assumptions about what that means for them, but to ask, to be direct. And it might just simply be, okay, tell me what that means, right? And, you know, it may be that the person who is in sex addiction recovery has been given some guidance on how to have that conversation early on. I always recommend it, have it up front. And that doesn't mean going into all the history of the trauma and all the things. It just says, you know, I'm in recovery from X, Y, and Z, and this is what that looks like for me. I go to meetings and things of that nature. So if it's the other person who's asking, be curious, be sensitive, but also not necessarily worry about causing a trigger, right? But leave that to the other person to make an informed decision for him or herself about what's appropriate for them and for them to communicate that, right? But, you know, I just think it's important to just have the conversation, to be open and non-judgmental. A lot of people have their own opinions about sex addiction, whether it, you know, exists or if it's real or whatever, right? But if you come across someone who's in addiction recovery, who says to you that they are in addiction recovery, just listen. I think that's really important. Do not assume that you know what's going on underneath that until they tell you.
If you were talking earlier about having a plan, could you maybe give our listeners a bit of a sense of what kinds of things might be on somebody's plan when they go back into the dating world, and to also to prevent relapses?
Yeah, so I actually created a little ebook. It's called Love and Joy. It's on my website, and also accessible on Amazon, where people can download it. And the plan really looks at, like, what's your vision for the relationship, right? And also ask a couple questions about what's the status of your recovery. Like, so if you're, you know, struggling with some sobriety, maybe dating is not the thing that you're pursuing at the time, right? And so it's important to kind of know where you currently are in your recovery. It's important to know what that vision is, and also to break out those, you know, ideal qualities or green flags that you're looking for, the yellow flags. What are the warning signs? Really, for warning signs, you need to know, you need more information, right? And then the red flags, what are those deal breakers? And have those outlined. And then share that with someone you trust and get some honest feedback on what that means.
And we are definitely making the links available to DJ's website and everything in our show notes. So check those out. You can check out this resource.
Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, is there anything else you would like to tell us today before we break about treatment? Like, maybe someone's like, oh, maybe I have a problem with this. Should I consider counseling? Maybe I'm a little bit nervous. Like, could you maybe talk a little bit about what that process might be like for someone? Again, understanding that there are going to be individual differences. And also, if the person has a partner, I mean, you mentioned that you ended up having to exit your relationship, but is that the case for everybody? Like, how might a partner actually be involved in the recovery? So anything you can kind of share about that, I don't know, maybe it might put some minds at ease.
Yeah, I think entering into therapy and recovery for anything can bring about a lot of emotions, anxieties, fears, you know, stress. I say, one, you know, identifying a provider who has, you know, who's very clear in their marketing materials, their websites or whatever, that they address those problems, right? Of course, checking that out, see if they have availability and all the things that we have to be, you know, considerate about when scheduling an appointment with a doctor. Do they take my insurance? Do they take private pay? Whatever, right? Those are some things just to start you off. But to, check with providers and asking them direct questions about how they help people who are considering entering into treatment or considering looking at sex addiction as a condition that they might experience, taking any kind of assessments that they might have, getting the information about what that actually means. If you are a partner who had it, if you're partnered with someone in sex addiction recovery, I think it's important to know what that recovery looks like for them. You know, are they going to meetings? Do they have a sponsor? Are they going to therapy? What sobriety looks like for them? You know, one of the things that I help folks with in my practice is disclosures. So if a person comes to see me and they're married and their partner or wife or husband doesn't know about their addiction, part of that process is helping them have that conversation. So having a therapeutic disclosure with myself, my client, their partner, their partner's therapist. So that's a whole thing too, right? And so it's different for everyone. You know, I just encourage people that if you think that you have a problem, check it out.
And, you know, you already mentioned briefly that you had dealt with addictions yourself, and now you are in a much better place in your life. You mentioned, like, happily married, life's going well for you. So it certainly sounds like you are an example of what life can look like on the other side of having gone through an addiction, but to be in recovery and to be committed to that. Was there a time where you ever felt like a happy future isn't for me, or getting out of this is just not something that is going to happen for me? Or did you always know one day I'm going to be able to overcome this?
You know, I think in the beginning I was very distressed, distraught, lots of despair before I got into recovery. I was in a very abusive, addictive relationship, and I didn't think that things would get better. But thankfully, I found a provider who called out that, one, I was suffering from codependency, I was suffering from my own addictions, not just my partner had an addiction, but I also had an addiction. So I appreciate being called to the carpet, right? To have that mirror held up and reflected back. This is what I'm actually seeing. And that was difficult for me to experience, especially as a healthcare provider. I didn't know that I also needed to be in treatment, right? Because that's the nature of addiction. And so working with a respected provider who was careful and kind and compassionate and was able to tell me that there is another way. And for me, that meant that I had to exit a relationship where my partner was not interested in recovery, was not available to get their own treatment. And that was sad. But I got to get my life back and figure out who I was and identify what my actual values were, what my actual needs and wants were. And I surrounded myself with a brand new community of people of support, something I had not had, especially seeing I came from a dysfunctional family system. And then after a few years of sobriety, I was able to kind of put it on paper as what I wanted, and I pursued that. And I was very specific, you know, in my dating plan of what I was looking for, and I found it. You know, I created an environment for myself that was conducive to having a healthy relationship, and it is possible to do that and attain that. And so I encourage people to, you know, to fight for it.
I think those are some inspiring words. I say we end on that note because it gives hope to people, and not just a vague sense of hope, but a pathway through which you get to DJ where we see you at today, and where people can believe if somebody helps you see you are a person of worth, you deserve better than what you're struggling with right now. And it might mean some sacrifice. It might mean some hard changes. But if you know, can commit to the action steps that it will take to get there. And if you can surround yourself with supportive people who support you in what you're working towards, that this kind of future is possible. I think you are an inspiration, both in terms of your own story and in terms of the good work you do to help others who are suffering.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you enjoy this podcast, please rate it 5 stars so that others have a chance to listen to it as well. And make sure to subscribe so that you can get our future episodes. All our platforms are accessible at strangersoninternet.com. Again, that's strangersoninternet.com. There's no the in there. You can become a part of our community by joining the Strangers on the Internet Facebook group or following us at Swipe Strangers on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, or Mastodon, where we are on the Faustodon server with 2 S's. We also appreciate support to defray our costs to run the podcast. You can help us out at Swipe Strangers on ko-fi.com, which is ko-fi.com. I would like to thank my husband, Carlos Farini, for sound editing, as well as Vlad Kujuklu for permission to use his music for this podcast. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.